This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is Claire McDonnell and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast. Today, are we witnessing a major breakthrough in the campaign to re-establish abortion rights in the US? Well, last week a judge in Texas ruled there wasn't enough clarity in the law for women with serious pregnancy complications. The state has now appealed that ruling, but could this signify the beginning of a woman's right to abortion being re-established? Also on today's programme, we'll hear from Dr. Julie Ebner, an author and researcher who has spent the last 2 years clandestinely observing the world of incels. They are involuntary celibates on the internet. Now, these are men with extreme views who feel disenfranchised from society. They often go on to commit violence against themselves and others. But the question she's asking in her new book is, are those once extremist views now taking hold in the mainstream? She'll join us live. Andrea Costand has been called the Joan of Arc of the Me Too movement, the woman who took Bill Cosby to court on a sexual assault allegation and won. Now, he was jailed but then freed after a court overturned his conviction on a legal technicality. Andrea and other women involved in the case are telling their stories in a new two-part documentary for ITVX. Andrea Costand will join us live. And fabulous live music from Chloe Massaru, who went from captaining boats in the Merchant Navy to being an award-winning singer, songwriter and harpist. She's going to join me live in the Woman's Hour studio. And also, this is where you get involved today. After lioness Rachel Daly was seen kissing a wristband with her late father's name on it after her successful penalty in the team's win against Nigeria yesterday. That was a tribute, you may remember, that was started when coach Serena Wiegmann paid homage to her late sister in the Euros last year in the very same way. I would love to know how you share your moments of triumph with someone you've lost. Is it a wristband? Is it a few chosen words? Is it a visit to an important spot? You can text the programme. The number is 84844. Texts are going to be charged at your standard message rate. On social media, we are at BBC Women's Hour. And you can email us through our website or you can send us a WhatsApp message or voice note. The number you need is this, 03700 100 444. Data charges may apply depending on your provider, so you might want to use Wi-Fi if you can. And terms and conditions can be found on our website. So let's start then with this judge in Texas who has ruled that women who experience pregnancy complications are temporarily exempt from the state's abortion bans. Now, the ruling comes after a group of 13 women and two doctors sued the state of Texas in March of this year, calling for a clarification of the law. However, the injunction is only temporary until the lawsuit is decided, and the state of Texas has now appealed the ruling within hours, which effectively puts that ruling on hold. Let's talk this through with Dr. Emma Long, an associate professor in American history and politics at the University of East Anglia. Welcome to Woman's Hour.
Good morning.
Let's go back to the beginning, how this lawsuit came about. Fill us in.
So it started actually way before last summer when the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade and handed decisions about abortion back to the states. Texas had been one of those states with a conservative majority that wanted to challenge Roe versus Wade. So they introduced two laws, one which banned abortion after 15 weeks, and another later one which banned abortion after 6 weeks. Of course, when the Supreme Court last summer in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health overturned Roe versus Wade, that 6 week law was there and ready to go into effect. So what happened last June was that law sort of almost immediately came into effect. The impact is that since most pregnant people don't know they're pregnant before 6 weeks, was to in effect outlaw almost all abortions in Texas. So you find women having to travel if they can to other states to access abortion care. In the case of these particular women who either had to do that or couldn't do that, they brought this lawsuit to challenge this law on the grounds that, as you said in the beginning, that the wording simply is not clear enough as to when doctors may use their discretion to conduct abortions after 6 weeks. So that's how we get to where we are now.
So it comes down to the phrase pregnancy complications and how that is defined. And I guess that could be defined in many, many ways. So what are they asking? What change are they asking for?
So the problem is that it's twofold, really. One is that language isn't clear. And as you say, different people can interpret it in different ways. The other thing is the way in which the law in Texas is enforced. So it's not enforced by the state. They gave the option to any individual who feels like they have been harmed by a practice to bring a lawsuit. So that could be a relative. It could be somebody who works in a hospital. It could be a taxi driver who drove a woman to the clinic who thought that this would be a problem. And of course, the argument that the doctors and these women made was that this is a medical decision. When a doctor decides that an abortion is necessary to save the health of the woman or that a pregnancy isn't viable, it's a medical decision that many without medical training are not going to understand. So the fear is that doctors would make legitimate medical decisions that wouldn't be understood by those outside of that situation, and they would get sued anyway. And the women involved in this case themselves have simply said, we were denied legitimate care that would have been legal under the law. We were either put at risk of, our health was put at risk, our lives were put at risk, or we had to go to significant expense to travel outside of state to find this care, all because the wording of this law is not clear.
And to be clear,
so they're asking for clarity.
What's happening at the moment then is if you are in one of these situations and potentially your life could be at risk or the life of your unborn child, then you have to go out of state to find a solution.
Yeah, pretty much as things currently stand. And this is their argument that's a violation of their basic rights to healthcare. You know, in the Texas law does include exceptions to save the life and the health of the mother, but because the wording is not clear, they are not getting that service. So one of the women involved in this case, she developed sepsis, and it was entirely predictable. The doctors told her, because of the circumstance, that it was highly likely that she would develop sepsis, which of course is life-threatening, but that they couldn't do anything until she developed sepsis. So you've got that example of somebody who then wasn't able to travel for that. Another of the women who were able to travel but are put through, you know, a very difficult circumstance in already difficult circumstances when perhaps they've been told that the child that they're carrying simply won't survive. So you add on to the difficulty of being told that you then have to make arrangements to travel outside of the state because the doctors who are treating you just aren't sure that the exact situation you find yourself in is going to be covered by the law.
So it affects women, obviously, and it affects doctors as well to cover them. There were doctors, two were involved in this lawsuit, weren't they? So they must be breathing some kind of sigh of relief today.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, yes and no. Yes, because I think the ruling from the judge in Texas recognizes that this is a problem, and that's important in and of itself. The state had argued that the law was perfectly clear, and if doctors weren't clear, that was their own fault. Whereas doctors are saying, look, we're seeing these patients on a daily basis and we can't. So I think from that point of view, it's a really important ruling on a practical level. At the moment, of course, as you pointed out, this hasn't been able to go into effect because the minute the state appealed, that ruling is put on hold, and they now have to wait for the Texas Supreme Court to decide whether the law is or is not clear. So at a practical level, it's not necessarily changing anything, but the ruling itself, even if it's not in effect, is really important, because what it's saying is you've got somebody in authority who's heard all the evidence, who's knowledgeable about this in the legal context, saying the state is wrong. The state isn't, the law is not clear on this. And actually, doctors and people who are pregnant need clearer guidelines than they're being provided at the moment.
We're already seeing the pushback. The Texas Attorney General's office has argued that the exceptions being pushed by the plaintiffs would effectively allow ways of bypassing the ban. And I quote, it would, for example, permit abortions for pregnant females with medical conditions ranging from a headache to feelings of depression. That is what they are saying. So how far can you litigate this in detail?
Well, you can litigate it. I think what comments like that indicate is that these laws, regardless of the language in which they were passed, were really intended to outlaw abortion. These laws in Texas and in other states across the US that have these strict laws, the motive to outlaw abortion, but they didn't necessarily want to come out and say, we are just banning it outright. So they put these very strict conditions and time limits on it, which all but bans it completely. But the problem is, if you've got exceptions in there, you have got exceptions in there. What this case has effectively said is you can't say that there are these exceptions and then not allow those exceptions to take place. The response to that, you know, well, if we give discretion to women and doctors, then, you know, they'll use it for any reason, is the argument that was made when Roe versus Wade was in place and in the years in between, which was, you know, abortion is too easy to access. It's abortion on demand. You know, so we're seeing the same debates just taking place in a slightly different context.
This, of course, is one loose lawsuit in one state. What is the picture like across the US right now? Are we seeing similar cases, legal cases, a year on from the overturning of Roe v. Wade? What's the overall picture?
There are cases. I mean, almost half of states now have some kind of abortion restriction that is stricter than it was under Roe versus Wade. And there are lawsuits in various states. They're expensive. They take a long time to bring to court. So partly why we've not heard so much about those as yet. But organizations and women and pregnant people are not sort of just sitting back and accepting it. They're trying to find ways to challenge it. So yes, we're going to see these kinds of cases. And it's one of the reasons why this Texas ruling is important, because what it does is it establishes an example of somebody in a conservative state saying, these are the terms you established, you have to live up to them in reality, not just in name. And while legally that doesn't have any impact in any of the other states, I think it's important as a first instance to show that actually some people are thinking that way.
Thank you so much for joining us on Woman's Hour, Dr. Emma Long there, Associate Professor in American History and Politics at the University of East Anglia. If you have a view on that, we would love to hear it. You can text the programme on 84844. Now, author and researcher Dr. Julia Ebner has spent the last 2 years immersed in one of the darkest corners of the internet, the world of incels. She has been pretending to be an unhappy, single, unemployed male in his late 20s who is tired of Feminism. Now, this is part of her work going undercover, investigating different extremist movements and how they pose a risk to democracy. Her new book is called Going Mainstream, and it looks at the rapid spread of extremism into our mainstream social and political discourse. I'm delighted to say Julia joins me now. Welcome to Woman's Hour.
Good morning. Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. Let's go back to what got you into this very dark area of research. It was a very personal experience, wasn't it?
It was in many ways. I started first studying extremism, terrorism and radicalization when ISIS was just at the height of their power and recruiting foreign fighters, but also launching attacks across Europe, of course, also in the UK. And I actually had some friends who were caught up in the area of Bataclan when the attack happened in Paris. So that really led to me being even more motivated on a personal level to pursue this, these investigations and this kind of research to stop terrorist attacks from happening.
And you were interested in Bataclan because it was the first time so-called Islamic State had actually recruited from mainland Europe.
Exactly. I was initially looking mainly at European foreign fighters and in general at jihadism, terrorism occurring based on kind of Islamist extremist radicalization. But I then also soon started to realize that the far right was really benefiting from some of these attacks as well, because they could recruit more people because there was this backlash where more and more people were developing resentments against Muslim communities in general, I would say against minority communities and migrants. So the far right also saw a surge in their recruitment and in their mobilization back then. And that led me to look at the far right extremist side of the spectrum.
So one fed the other. And then you thought, I'm going to go in deep. I'm going to try and understand what motivates these people. So talk us through how you immerse yourselves in these groups. You have an avatar, essentially, don't you?
Exactly. I do have many avatars to go undercover with different types of extremist movements. So I've been doing undercover investigations with Islamist extremists, including ISIS hacking groups and ISIS jihadi bride groups, but also with neo-Nazi groups and white nationalist groups, with QAnon groups, as well as misogynist groups. And for this latest book, I've been doing this kind of research for 7 years now, sometimes going undercover online, but sometimes also taking these investigations to the real world and meeting in offline settings. But for this latest book, I also developed an avatar that was male under the pseudonym of Alex Williamson, essentially a lonely man who was getting radicalized into the incel, into the violent misogynist incel community, because I wanted to understand better what is driving people inside these deeply misogynistic subcultures that we can find on the internet.
You witnessed some pretty dark and disturbing conversations, didn't you, when you adopted this persona? Can you talk us through some of them?
I would say the incel community was one of the scariest places for me personally. I've done many undercover investigations in different extremist groups, but incels was very special in the sense that, of course, for me as a woman, it all felt very personal quite quickly, because the threat here is against women, and women are seen as the main enemy. So if you enter this very toxic world, you will soon see fantasies of raping women, of even carrying out terrorist attacks. There are even sometimes attacks being plotted on these platforms. Whenever I spotted something like that, I, of course, forwarded it to the responsible authorities or security services. But it's a very toxic world. And there is almost a sense that the community is split into some people. Some incels would lean more towards self-loathing and towards hatred of themselves that can then mean that they might resort to suicide. They definitely share a lot of suicide fantasies. And other parts are more leaning towards hatred against a demonized outgroup, in many cases women, but also good-looking men, for example, who are seen as the enemy. And that has in the past also inspired terrorist attacks, as we saw in the UK with the Plymouth attack not so long ago, but also in Canada, the Toronto van attack of 2018. In the US, there have been several attacks And there is often not cases of violence that are less high profile than the big terrorist attacks that have gone under the radar of most people, I would say, that have not made it to the headlines, but that might have also been inspired by at least dimensions of this incel thinking or these misogynistic ideologies.
So you're in this world as a woman, but projecting as a man, this man you've described. And there's a figure here from the Centre of Countering Digital Hate that in these incel groups, on average, someone shares a rape fantasy every 29 minutes. How difficult was it for you to sit there and listen to that?
It was immensely difficult, especially because a lot of these really deeply misogynistic and even violent posts are coming from minors or from very young people who get caught up in this radicalization spiral. And so very often I felt the need to intervene also when people were sharing suicide fantasies. And then I could observe in real time how other users would further feed into that, into those suicide fantasies by sharing manuals of how to rope yourself or how to drown yourself. It was really quite a terrible group dynamic that developed there. And the same was true when rape fantasies or even death threats were being shared. It was often the case that incels were motivating each other to more and more aggressive language and more concrete plans to take action in the real world.
How do you balance that? You say, obviously, if you get wind of a potential attack, then you would flag that to the authorities. And yet everything else you've described is pretty violent or is goading others to violence. I mean, how do you balance, you know, not wanting harm to come to other people with clearly, obviously, your mission, which is to gather evidence, to put it to good use further down the line? I mean, it must be very difficult. You must feel very torn sometimes.
I did feel very torn many, many times. In general, being undercover with extremist groups just means that sometimes it's not possible to intervene because otherwise they would uncover the identity, of course, the real identity, or they would, the undercover identity would be blown. And that is sometimes also hard whenever, for example, sexist or racist jokes are being made. Also in real world offline settings, when I met extremists, I sometimes had to laugh at these jokes. And those are among the most difficult moments because you have to stay in character. But there were definitely a few instances where I tried to intervene. And in the past, that also sometimes led to my avatar being uncovered or to me being kicked out of a community, of an online community.
That must be quite scary. And I'll get on to, you know, what you think we as a society need to do, because your book's title, Going Mainstream, suggests that you don't feel it's on the fringes anymore. A lot of that ideology is kind of around us all the time. But I mean, how difficult is it for you personally? Because you must feel under threat, surely.
I've started to accept that this comes with just this profession, with looking at terrorism and radicalization dynamics. I've had many threats and hate campaigns targeted at myself, also at my colleagues in the past. And usually they come and go in waves. And I think it's something that not just researchers in this type of field are experiencing, but of course also local politicians, activists, journalists are more and more exposed to these types of hate campaigns, where it's almost impossible to speak out loud about controversial topics or to raise awareness about extremism and radicalization, because you might become a target of these campaigns. And there were moments when I faced severe death threats and rape threats, and I was considering just completely exiting this space and not continuing this kind of work anymore. But that's ultimately the goal of these extremist movements. It is to silence any kind of opposition and any kind of work that might hinder them from their own missions. So I think it's necessary to not be silenced by these intimidation campaigns.
What's going mainstream then? Are you talking about people like Andrew Tate, for example, where, you know, a lot of young men these days, this is a man who is held up as someone to admire, whose philosophy on life as a young man is studied? I mean, is this the kind of thing you're talking about?
Andrew Tate is definitely a good example because he has mainstreamed some of the very fringe, sometimes even violent, misogynistic ideas and ideologies, and even conspiracy myths that that would also be shared in the incel community or in the wider online misogynistic mosaic of what's called the manosphere. That's not just made up of incels, but also of other misogynistic communities. For example, the pickup community, which is basically men who are trying to manipulate women into having sex with them. Andrew Tate, of course, has accumulated millions of followers and views on his TikTok videos, and many of them are among the youngest generations. And we also do observe that there is, even in school classrooms in the UK, also in Germany, more kids, especially teenage boys, are sharing rape glorification ideas or rape denial ideas, and might also see Andrew Tate as their role model. And equally, there is, we can see in studies that some of the language, some of the symbols that come from very extreme fringe corners of the internet, such as incels, that some of this specific vocabulary has leaked into public discourse and now has been normalized and is being used by wider parts of the population and of internet users. Examples are the Sigma male meme, but also words like feminazis, for example, where we see that some of these words are being taken out of these fringe communities and do inspire a much wider, of course, lower level, but still a lower level misogyny that can then be quite dangerous on a societal and on a political level.
So the book flags all of this brilliantly and brings it out in the open for us all to discuss it. I know you're developing a formula for different psychological factors that always come together when people turn to violence and translate words into action. So briefly, if you could tell us a little bit about that and also what everyone can do to kind of stem this tide.
Yeah, this formula that I developed was part of my PhD research at Oxford University, where I studied patterns in the terrorist manifestos that were published shortly before attacks happened in the last 10 years. And I did find that there was a very clear pattern of recurring factors, psychological factors that could be found in the language of terrorist, of terrorist perpetrators in their manifestos. So one of the key elements here is identity fusion, which is when the personal identity becomes one, becomes equivalent with the group identity. Having said that, actually, the incel community is a slight exception to this phenomenon. But in many of the other extremist communities, that is a clear sign that people might be more prone to violence, especially when this phenomenon of identity fusion occurs together with other factors like a perceived existential threat from an outgroup, or the dehumanization of this outgroup, and of course also violence condoning norms. But I've been trying to develop this formula so that, for example, the security services and the intelligence community have an easier job in allocating resources towards those investigations that really are the most credible in terms of the level of threat of real world violence. Because right now there are so many threats online and so many announcements of violence or fantasies of violence that it's really hard for the intelligence community to sort through them and to prioritize which ones do they investigate further, which ones can they just leave beside.
Well, it's really important research, and we thank you so much for bringing it to us. We could talk for the next half hour on all of this. It's utterly fascinating and it affects all of our lives. Dr. Julia Ebner, thank you so much for joining us on Woman's Hour, and her new book is Going Mainstream. It is out now. Joan's been in touch. Thank you for this, Joan. Hatred of Women is Pervasive. How We Raise Our Boys Has to Change. Julia has very important points on that as well. And I was asking you earlier, Rachel Daly, one of the lionesses, kissed a wristband after she put that penalty away yesterday at the Women's World Cup against Nigeria. How do you mark the moments of celebration in your life? How do you share that with a loved one you have lost? This texter, I had a wooden bench placed in Dad's local gardens and shared this fact with his friends and our family. For the next 10 years, people can see the plaque Sid and remember him. Thank you so much for that. Thank you, whoever you are. And Kate says, our dad died 10 years ago from complications after a stem cell transplant for lymphoma. And whilst he has always been with us, remembering him, excuse me, has always been very personal for my sister Anna and I this year, we both felt ready to do something and more public to mark that milestone and took part in the London Triathlon for the first time on Sunday to raise money for Blood Cancer UK and help other families have better outcomes. I felt Dad was with me all the way round and was elated to finish the competition in his honour, especially as we doubled our target to raise £3,000. The donor page is still open, still buzzing from it. This would have been a voice note, but I don't think I could have got through it. It's been emotional. Kate, thank you so much for texting us. Please do text the programme. You still have time. 84844. How, in those moments of triumph in your life, you bring a dearly departed loved one with you. We would love to hear from you here on Woman's Hour this morning. Now to Listener's Week, which begins on the 21st of August. Is there a science or tech-related topic you would like us to cover? Maybe it's about AI, robotics or space travel. Or maybe you'd like to nominate a woman in STEM who is doing interesting research and revolutionising the way women eat, work or sleep. You can get in touch. Again, you can text Women's Out on 84844. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. You can check with your network provider for exact costs. On social media, it's at BBC Women's Hour, or you can email us through our website. Do get in touch on that.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Now, delighted to say, Chloe Matheroux is an award-winning singer-songwriter and harpist. She has cultural roots in Scotland and Wales and the Punjab and draws inspiration from her time spent as a navigational officer in the Merchant Navy and the natural world as experienced at sea. She's got a debut album out. It's called Small Voyages, and it was selected for Celtic Music Radio's Album of the Year. At Celtic Connection, she was awarded the revered Danny in February of this year. And I'm delighted to say she joins me in the studio now along with her harp. Chloe, hello.
Hi there. It's lovely to be here.
It's fantastic. So, and that is a beautiful instrument. I saw you struggling out of the lift with it earlier, and I admired you for that, because it must be quite something taking that with you everywhere.
This is, believe it or not, my travel instrument. So I actually have a larger instrument, but I didn't think I'd fit it on the train. So
I love that harps come in travel size, like cosmetics. Absolutely brilliant. You've had such an interesting life, haven't you? Here you are, an accomplished musician, now with a debut album out. But you started off in the Merchant Navy. How on earth did that happen?
So from about the age of eight, I became fascinated with oil tankers, and it was something that just stayed with me. And I think it was, probably sounds quite nerdy, but it was really the colours of the tankers that really caught my imagination, the red and the blue and the white. And I just kept wondering what life at sea would be like. And so I looked into it after leaving school. I did music for a wee while, but I actually decided that I wanted to still experience what life was like at sea. And no one from my family had been to sea, so it seemed like a very exciting thing to do. And so I applied for a cadetship, and I got a sponsorship with a local Fisher, James Fisher Tankers, that was a UK-based oil tanker company. And so I spent my time on oil tankers before finishing and qualifying, and I moved on to cruise ships, then ferries and tugboats.
And when you say moved on, were you sailing these things? Were you in charge?
Yeah, so how it works is that the navigational officer, there's a team of deck officers that drive the ship, and so we all do watches. And so at any time of the when you're a qualified officer, you are actually driving that vessel. So, navigating around the world on my ships.
What was the percentage of women to men?
It really depended on which ship you were on. But in the intake to Nautical College, I was one in 80 men that actually was taken into Fleetwood Nautical College. And that was quite interesting because I did think that there would be a few more females. But to be honest, it was an amazing experience. I would really highly recommend a career at sea to anyone.
Because you were at St Andrews University, weren't you, initially? Decided this isn't for me. Tell us why.
So actually, it's interesting that this conversation about incels and some of the language they used is mentioned because something that drove me away from St Andrews was this community of vocal men that would say things like they were very entertained by the idea of rape, and that would often come up on nights out. And I just felt like I was exposed to that a lot just through the community of young men there. And I got sick of it. And I remember one time being in a pub in St Andrews, and we tried to go in as a group of females, and actually there was a group of young men in red cloaks and they booed us out of the pub. And that was just indicative of what it was like in the social life at St Andrews. And I just thought it really wasn't for me. So I ended up deciding to apply for the Merchant Navy and going to do something that was professional from the start.
And the difference then between the male experience you had at St Andrews to the male experience you had, predominantly male, in the Merchant Navy was what?
Well, it's a professional environment. So when you apply to be in the Merchant Navy, from day one of your training, even though you're at Nautical College studying, you're actually being paid by a company. So if you step out of line, you'll essentially lose your job. And from day one, it was made very clear that anyone who got in the way of other people's training would be kicked out of the college. And so I just felt there was a sense of discipline and that people kept their head down and focused on the work and really kept out of my way.
So a lot more respectful, that environment.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, you've gone into this incredible world of folk music now. How did that begin?
So I grew up in Edinburgh, and I think there's just a really strong community of musicians in Scotland, and especially in Edinburgh, there's lots of live sessions. I started going to the Youth Gathering Sessions, which is a youth initiative, and they've got amazing musicians that lead those. So I was under some classes with Corinne Polwart and Julie Fowlis. So it was really inspiring for me to be exposed to that from a young age. And I got into singing Scottish a cappella music. And it wasn't until later on that, I mean, I learned the harp as a 10-year-old, but it wasn't until later on in recent years that I've put the voice and harp together. But I just think that the harp lends itself so well to these songs that I write. And it's all about being at sea, and I think the instruments somehow, the flow of it and the different sounds that you can get from the harp, it somehow reflects the sea so well.
Oh, I can't wait to hear it. You're a mother now, so you've come back shoreside, and some of the tracks on your album are inspired by your family. Your husband was in the Royal Navy, so that led to a song about a long distance relationship on the album, didn't it?
Yeah, so I think my aim through music is to lend a voice to the modern day seafarer. And I think that years ago, folk music, it really reflects the male narrative about being at sea and the large crews. And these days, being a seafarer means that you have to be alone a lot of the time, and it can be very lonely, and you're away from loved ones. So a lot of my music is about longing for loved ones. And that song that you mentioned, Arctic Terns, that was inspired by the beautiful bird of the Arctic Tern. And I used to keep in touch with my husband, who was on different vessels, by essentially nature watching from the bridge of the ship and emailing him what I'd seen so that we would keep in touch. So we'd be in different places in the world and we'd get these emails about what wildlife we'd seen, and it somehow kept us connected. And the Arctic Tern is special because actually they keep one mate for life, and they meet up with the same mate once a year in the same place, and they do this magnificent dance up into the air. And that caught my imagination as a lovesick seafarer, and I really wanted to write something that was reflective of me and my husband. So that's how that song came about.
That's absolutely beautiful. Is that the one you're going to play for us now?
No, so I've just released a single called The Silky of Soul Scary, and I collaborated with an electronic engineer. It's basically a Scots song, and we've done an electronic soundscape to include seal song and field recordings of the sea. And that's out now. And I'll be also playing at Edinburgh Fringe, promoting that on the 18th and 19th of August. And that's the song that I'll be playing today.
OK, well, listen, if you're ready, we're ready.
Brilliant.
Take it away. Absolutely breathtaking.
Thank you so much.
I wish we had an audience in here. I am sure the Woman's Hour audience are applauding all over the country. That was honestly absolutely incredible. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming in. Tell us where we can see you in Edinburgh.
So that will be at the Acoustic Music Centre on the 18th and 19th of August, and that's at 7 o'clock.
Okay, and the album?
It's called Small Voyages, and it's available on all streaming platforms as well as Bandcamp.
Very well done. Chloe, lovely to meet you. Thank you so much
for
bringing your travel harp in with you and for educating me that there were such things in the world. Chloe Matheru there, go and look her up. She really, obviously, as you just heard, is really worth a second visit. Thank you so much for coming in, Chloe. Now, let's move on to talk about a programme, a really important programme, a two-part documentary for ITVX. It's this: more than 60 women have made allegations of rape, sexual assault and sexual harassment against the US comedian and actor Bill Cosby. But only one woman, Andrea Constand, was able to gain a criminal conviction. In 2018, he was sent to prison for 3 to 10 years on 3 counts of aggravated indecent assault. Now, at the time, it was celebrated as a major win for the Me Too movement. Less than 3 years later, he was freed when the Pennsylvania Supreme Court overturned his conviction on a legal technicality. Well, this new two-part documentary for ITVX is called The Case Against Cosby, and Andrea tells her story. Delighted to say, Andrea joins us now. Welcome to Woman's Hour.
Thank you for having me. Good morning. Almost good afternoon.
Probably where you are, afternoon here. Why did you feel it was important to tell this story now, 20 years on from when it first began?
Well, I thought it was important to tell the story, to show the journey of survivors, obviously, and to highlight, not only the authenticity, and to really kind of talk about the trauma, which is what we really dive very deeply into this documentary. Trauma can be really uncomfortable and painful, especially, watching other people go through it, although we don't often do that unless we're in a group setting or in a retreat or in group therapy. But I thought it was important just to kind of dive into the truth of the story, into the authenticity of the story, and to actually shine a light on the survivors. Because in so many instances, when predators and abusers are powerful, wealthy, famous people, often the limelight is on them. And I felt that in this story, it was important to work with the director to really show the damage and the collateral damage that is often done with sexual assault survivors, not only for them, for their families, for their friends. And I think you get to see what it's like in the world of a survivor in this documentary, and we're very proud of it. So
you really do. It's traumatic, but at the same time, very uplifting. And if you don't mind, for people who don't know your story, just to go back to the beginning of this, you describe yourself as confident, outgoing, 29 to 30 year old, working at Temple University in Philadelphia. So tell us how your paths crossed with Bill Cosby back then.
Yeah. So, at the time, it was really the culmination of my dream job in the basketball world. And I had played basketball as a youngster and went on to college and received a scholarship. And so for me, and then also played as well in Europe for a couple of years. I kind of ended my career in Italy playing professionally in the first league there. And so this was kind of a job that I kind of came back to, and it was a dream job for me with a head coach that was actually an incredible head coach. And I happened to be at a basketball game. I had already been at Temple for just over a year, and I was at a basketball game, and that's how I crossed paths with Bill Cosby. I was introduced to him by another trustee at the university. And, you know, all under the guise of wanting to look at the new locker room that we had installed at the arena. And it was all very innocent, you know, but after 18 months of a friendship and a mentorship, you know, obviously it wasn't innocent and it wasn't a friendship. It was very much, you know, 18 months of knowing him, of being groomed by him, only to culminate in an evening at his home, where I was given a few blue pills and became unconscious. And, you know, like I say in the documentary, the Andrea that I was, like you say, confident, bright-eyed, a free spirit, you know, I walked out of his house a completely different person. And just one night really changed me. And so, you know, that's become my journey. The past 20 years has really been a healing journey for me. And I think, you know, I think it was important to do this documentary to actually show what it's like for survivors to heal and what that looks like. But for me, it's been a 20-year journey. And I look at the person who I am today, and I never thought that I could ever be the person that I am today back then.
You buried this, though, didn't you, when you walked out of that house? But everybody around you noticed you changed quite significantly.
Yes, yes, I did. You know, it's that humiliation and that shame, you know, and I think often those situations really disconnect us, you know, from who we really are and our ability to speak out and you know, and stay silenced. I think for me also, you know, as for many people, sometimes it's you know, a relative, a person you work with, you know, a harassment in the workplace. You know, the harassment and the assault can just it can show up in any way. But yeah, it's been a journey.
And this is the journey you take us on. I mean, just to give people detail who haven't followed your case, you launched the civil case in 2005, criminal charges filed in 2017, because there was a settlement, and then you effectively sort of moved on with your life, didn't you, after this civil case and settlement. So what exactly was it that brought you out again to say, you know, this was the time to face him in court?
Yeah, it's a very good point. I went through all that, the civil stuff, which was really, you know, early on, it was tough because I was going up against such a powerful person. And then the criminal case, of course, which was very daunting, really daunting process for me. Although I did look, you know, I was strong, and I think I was strong enough to have been the person to go through that. But I think ultimately, you know, it was my drive for closure is really what kept me going. And I really felt like it was very hard to watch all the other survivors come forward. You know, as they came forward, it was like back in the civil case, we knew that there were 13 Jane Does in my case, but my case never went to trial, but I knew there were other women. And so that for me was a bigger secret, although I had a secret for a whole year that I held inside of what he did to me. I came out of, you know, that civil situation with an even bigger secret that he had done this to other people. And so I think knowing in 2000, and, you know, fast forward to 2017 when I started to hear, in 2018 when I started to hear a lot of the other women's stories come forward, it was really emotional for me to watch and to see them all come forward. You know, and they were kind of paraded in front of the media, you know, and often left in tears. And so it was really emotional for me. And I think having seen that, having seen the impact and the hurt, you know, and you know, what this man, who he truly was and what he led a life of. I mean, to everybody, he was America's dad at the time. You know, he was, you know, all over the world. I'm sure probably in the UK as well, there might be people that have seen his early shows like The Cosby Show or Fat Albert. But I wanted to show the truth of who he really was. And so for me, I had to sacrifice, you know, a lot of my life and a lot of many, almost 4 or 5 years going through those trials, you know, to kind of get that justice. It was what I so desired was to get justice, you know, to show the truth of who he was. And so that is really what drove me. And, you know, I look back now and I'm like, you know, at photos of me, you know, coming out of the courtroom, et cetera, and I often say, like, I don't know how I did it. It's surreal that I actually got through.
Well, you are called
what I got through.
You're called in this documentary the Joan of Arc of the Me Too movement, because people are saying, even though they didn't get their convictions, the fact that you did eventually get a conviction felt like that they were exonerated as well, because Bill Cosby was sentenced to prison for 3 to 10 years in 2018. But as I mentioned earlier, less than 3 years later, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court overturned the verdict on a legal technicality. He has always maintained his innocence. So what impact did that Supreme Court decision have on you? He was a free man.
Well, you know, it's really, like, for me, I think having, when I was going through the trials, you know, my mantra really was, and it's part of my spirituality, was really to have no expectations around what was going to happen. Because it's funny, you know, as I walked through the whole criminal situation, with which took a few years, I really realized that I didn't have much control over anything. And some people might have thought I had more control than I did, but I actually didn't. From the time that I committed to, you know, to taking the journey and actually bringing him to justice, I didn't have control over court decisions, court motions. I just had to go with the flow. And a part of me was just like, don't have expectations, Andrea, because I didn't want to be set up to be let down. And so part of that journey was having no expectations. When he was sentenced and handcuffed and taken off to jail, that was a real big moment for me. And it was a big moment for all of us, because we felt believed, we felt heard by the jury. We felt that, you know, when he, after he had served 3 years, you know, for me, I was just happy that he had served a minimum time. Although it was not anywhere I felt the true crime and the true breadth of all the predation he had committed deserved 10 years, believe me. But having seen him serve 3 years, it was okay with me. I was okay with everything. But what I was not okay with is the message that it would send to other survivors, you know, who might be coming forward, who might want to report to the police what their abusers have done to them, because they might think, you know what? Well, look at Andrea's situation. She reported, yeah, he went to jail, but he, you know, he only got the minimum term. He ended up coming out. So I didn't want that to serve as a message that, you know, don't bother coming forward because it's really not worth it. It is worth it. I can sit here today and say it's worth it. It's worth it for your healing. It's worth it, you know, to not stay in silence anymore, because silence, ultimately, it will make us sick. Our secrets will make us sick. And so for me, I would say, get on with it. Get on with the healing path. You know, get the support that you need. Reach out. And hopefully to all those people that are listening out there, if somebody ever does tell you that something has happened to them, just acknowledge them and believe them and ask them if they're okay. That's important.
It's a hugely uplifting watch. It's traumatic, but it's really worth a view for all of the reasons you've outlined. And I know Andrea now, Director of Hope and Healing and Transformation, which supports sexual survivors. So thank you so much for joining us on Woman's Hour today. Do give that two-part documentary a watch. It's on ITVX. It is The Case Against Cosby, Andrea Constand, and other survivors tell their story. We do have to tell you, though, obviously, Bill Cosby maintains that all sexual encounters were consensual, and he has maintained his innocence in Andrew's case. The Case Against Cosby, as I said, will be available to stream on ITVX exclusively from Thursday, the 10th of August. That's almost it from Woman's Hour from today. Just to say earlier, our guest Chloe Matheroux mentioned her experiences at St Andrews University. We have contacted them for a response, but understandably, we have not heard back yet. Thank you so much for all of your comments. You've got in touch with us how you mark the celebratory moments in your life with the passing of a loved one. My father died 12 years ago and taught me lots of DIY skills. Listening now, I'm doing some patching up, plastering in my kitchen. I've just put his initials in a discreet spot. What a lovely text. And last month, I was awarded an honorary doctorate, just like Anita Rani, one of my heroines. I wanted to dedicate this award to my grandmother and grandfather, who were very important in my life and career trajectory. I wore my grandmother's wedding ring and outlined my grandfather's life in my acceptance speech. That's all from today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
Hi, it's Amit Katwala.
And Charlotte Stavrou here. We wanted to tell you that Season 2 of All Consuming from BBC Radio 4 is here.
In this series, we'll be once again delving into our culture of consumption by examining the services and products that have changed the world.
This time, we're looking at houseplants.
I fell in love with that madly. The idea of just turning a plant into this giant analog synthesizer.
Running shoes.
The beauty of it is you get a chance to understand performance at the highest level.
And tea.
It's the connection and the safety cues to your body that it's over and you're safe.
And much more. So join us for the second season of All Consuming, available on BBC Sounds.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.